Well, I'm Barry Billings, and a Muscle Shoals musician, songwriter, guitar player. Do some engineering and some producing, and teaching. I've been teaching for many years here, so that's kind of, I guess, awesome. Part of my job description.
There. Yeah. Yeah. So I know you've played with a lot of different bands over the years. Mm-hmm. Tell me maybe some of the bands that you played with.
I guess, you know, of note, you know, right out of high school, I went on the road with Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose, and they had had two or three, four songs at least that charted. They had Too Late to Turn Back Now. That was like a big hit, and a song called Treat Her Like a Lady. That was a really big hit. They play those on the oldie stations, you know, to this day, and that was pretty fun. I guess I did that for 3 to 4 years, you know, just right out of high school.
Wow.
And then I guess I went back to Huntsville. That's where I grew up, and started playing around town a good bit, and started getting, you know, kind of like I was in the little circle of musicians that always worked. And, you know, if I left one job, if somebody heard I was available, then I would move right into another job. So, but it was just a circle. And so I decided, you know, I was going to bought some recording equipment. And, you know, I had already been messing around with songwriting. You know, I've been trying to do that, you know, forever. And so I got a key to a recording studio in Huntsville. And when I'd get done playing at night, I would go to the recording studio and try to record the songs I'd written and try to learn about recording. That was at Sound Cell Recording Studio there in Huntsville. And I went from, it just blew up so quick as far as the equipment. I went from not knowing how to fill up 8 tracks to not knowing how to fill up 16 tracks to not knowing how to fill up 24 tracks. And every night I would come in and the patch bay would be different. He would have changed, the owner, Doug Smith, would have changed the patch bay around for some reason. And he would leave me a note like, okay, here's what I did. And so it was, every night was like different. But I finally, it was like, you know, I think I got sick. I got with mono, and it seemed like it turned into this chronic fatigue syndrome thing. And I wound up, the band I was working in at the time, it was, you know, we were doing cover music and stuff. And me and the lead singer, I guess, she didn't, we didn't see eye to eye about some things. They were going to fire a drummer that I had learned a lot from, and I kind of stood up for him, so we both got fired on the same night. But that's... And when the people started calling, you know, to get me to come to a different place to play, it was like I was going, you know, this is just a vicious circle, you know, or a cycle. And I thought, you know, I want to try something different. And a friend of mine, Tommy Graham, he had met Gary Baker over here in the Shoals. And at the time, Gary had a band called the Gary Baker Band. And he said, man, he's like you, you know, he's the career, thinking about his career, he writes songs, he's going to Nashville all the time trying to sell, and he only works on the weekends, or mainly. And I thought, man, that sounds perfect, because I got this thing that where I'm tired all the time anyway, so, you know, I could, if I only had to work 2 days a week instead of six, like I was doing in the other, most of the other house bands over there worked 5 or 6 nights a week. So I came over here, and we practiced in Gary's basement. And Gary liked me, or I guess maybe auditioned. I don't know what you call it, but we hit it off pretty good. And within 6 months of coming over here doing that, we had a record deal. So it was like perfect timing. Wow. Just all the pieces. I, you know, always give credit to God for that, because, you know, there I was kind of sick and not really, you know. And all of a sudden, and I always thought in those days, this is mid-80s, mid to late 80s, that if everybody in music thought if you had a record deal, you had made it. Mm-hmm. You had arrived, was the, you know. And So Walt Aldridge, he was coming out to hear us real regular, and I kept seeing him. Like, he'd be leaning on the wall, and he'd be watching me, and he'd be watching, you know, the band. And Walt had the opportunity with CBS Epic Records to put a band together to do some of his material to do, and Gary's too, and mine possibly. You know, it was kind of an open situation there in the beginning, and Walt. So that's what happened. We got signed to CBS Epic and cut two albums for them. We had songs that charted.
And that was with Walt?
Yes. And the band was called The Shooters.
Oh, wow.
And that was me and Gary Baker, Walt Aldridge, Chalmers Davis on keyboards. Chalmers has moved to Jackson, Mississippi. And Mike Dillon, or Mike Currington, he goes by both. Was the drummer. So that was pretty much the band.
It's a great band. That's a great band.
It was, we had some pretty energetic for, like, it was the exact same time that Shenandoah got signed.
Gotcha.
So two groups from fame there got signed, us and Shenandoah. And Shenandoah was, you know, Robert Byrne had a lot of great songs. I don't know if you him, but he passed away a few years ago. Great songwriter. And the stuff was, wrote Two Dozen Roses, I think, you know, like some of Shenandoah's bigger hits. And they were a little more traditional than we were. We were kind of out there, way out on a limb for country music, real progressive. And at the time, it had kind of swung out that way. Like, I think the group Exile, there were quite a few groups that country groups that had kind of left traditional country and were kind of pushing the envelope. But we didn't get the chart success that, you know, that Shenandoah got, you know, there. And that their songs were great. We had some really good songs too, but we were just a little, like I say, more out on the fringe.
So did you like playing that style of music?
It was, you know, I was just happy to be. I've always been kind of that way. You know, I had friends that were more artsy people than I guess I was. If I was playing music, I was pretty happy. And so, like, I did a lot of the Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose. I guess you call them pop, but because that's how their songs charted. And but then, you know, I would go do a country gig. I didn't feel like I was a country guitar player, but I would do my best, you know, to hang in there with the country guys, and, you know, learned a lot. And so the Shooters were, we were signed as a country band, but we were a little more pop. So I guess that in that aspect, it fit me better. But yeah, I was always, and if, you know, if I'm getting to play my guitar, I'm pretty happy. I'm still that way to this day, but I've gotten a little bit more, be careful how I say these things, but I had a real high tolerance, I guess, for repetition, and I guess I still do, you know. But it finally, like now at the Marriott, when I go out and do my solo stuff, I've quit playing about any hit. I just play. Now I just like to play either songs people haven't heard or ones they've about forgotten, or my own songs. And so I should have been, and I've been trying to break into this for like years, but people knew I knew the cover stuff. So they would always be like, play this. And they knew I knew it. And I just had a lot of trouble telling them, I don't want to do this anymore.
So how did the deep cuts go over?
I think they go over well. You know, especially during this lockdown, it's like now that the Marriott's back open, it's like the tip jar's about tripled. You know, people are so happy to be out of the house and be able to hear some live music.
Absolutely.
You know, and so they're showing it in the tip jar, so that's really cool. And, you know, I try to still, like, bring some energy to it, you know, like I don't just do ballads all night, you know, I'll do some, like I do a I learned a Towns Van Zandt song from Clay and Jody when they were here. I saw him play it, and I like that song called Blackjack Mama. You know, so I'll do like these obscure up-tempo things that are pretty accessible, like anybody hearing it, you know, they could tap their foot to it if they want to. And I'd rather people come hear me anyway because they want to hear me and not hear some hit song that someone else did. So.
Yeah, it's almost like your playlist, you know? Like, you're curating all of these, like, really cool songs that people don't know about. That's awesome.
Yes, it's been a lot more fun for me. And you know, Larry Bowser, the GM over there, he's encouraged me from the first day he hired me. Man, do your stuff. Do your stuff. Do your songs, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, throw in some Muscle Shoals music. So I try to throw in, you know, some Shoals things, you know, but. But, yeah, he's been a big encouragement to me. So I know when I'm at the Marriott, I'm not going to get into trouble if I don't play, you know, a hit. And that's nice to know.
Larry Bowser's a good guy.
Yeah, he is.
From every interaction I've had with him, I'm always like, this guy's pretty genuine.
I love him.
Yeah. You know, it's the Marriott, but, man, being able to bring live music every single night of the week, that's special. It doesn't matter where it is.
Yeah, and most nights it's two acts a night. You know, you got the 5 to 7 and then the 7:30 to 10 now.
Yeah, so. I mean, I know it's like a big investment. I mean, maybe not for them, I don't know, but it really, like, I feel like it helps a lot of musicians just, like, have something consistent, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's important.
I do too. And they have a little bit of everything. You know, they have a lot of younger acts, and I love to go check them out and see, like, you know, and then some people are just really doing the hits, you know.
Yeah.
So but it's a pretty good variety comes through there, and most everybody's pretty dang good, you know. It's like even the people that are doing the material maybe I can't, don't really want to sit and listen to, or they're doing it well. You know?
Yeah, that's awesome. So, did you ever do session work, like, with, like, any of the bigger studios?
I did, probably all of them here. You know, I played on those Shooters recordings, and you know, I'd done some session work already in Huntsville, and got to play with the Swampers on a session. I think Will might have been out of town or something. This is back a long time ago, and that was really cool. That was back when Roger Hawkins was still playing, so I got to play with Roger before he, you know, just kind of retired. And so that was a really cool date. And David Hood, and I was real impressed with David, you know. Like, and David and I are good friends now. We've done quite a few sessions together, and the thing I liked about him was that, you know, a lot of session players, and as soon as they get something that is in time and in tune, and they're done, you know. But David sits there and thinks about what he played, and he's like, I got an idea. And he'll run back out there to something that's not really broke and come up with something even better. And, you know, that's what I like to do, you know. It's like, that's really cool that a guy like him, you know, would, you know, he really cares about the song, and he really wants to put something into it, you know, creatively.
And you feel like you do the same thing, kind of?
I like to think so. Yeah, I don't ever try to phone anything in, you know. And some, you know, but I try to also be aware that, you know, if the clock's running, that I can't just, you know, keep doing it over and over again till I get something I love. So a lot of times at that point, I depend on the client and the engineer, and also when they go, we got it. You got it. That's enough. You know, they can, with this stuff they got these days, they can piece stuff together. They can take the beginning of one solo and the middle of the next and the end of the third one, and, you know, and so you don't have to, you know, I'd prefer to play it straight through where they don't have to cut and paste stuff together, but, you know, it happens sometimes.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, you had mentioned that you grew up in Huntsville. Like, how did you get going in music, like, originally? Like, have you been playing since you were a kid?
Yeah, and, you know, I started you know, playing little parties and stuff in like eighth grade, you know, and they pay you a little bit of money, and then, you know, doing, not, that didn't happen very often. But then before I ever got my driver's license, the Arsenal over there had the, had three clubs you could play. They had the EM club, the enlisted men's club. They had the NCO club, the non-commissioned officers club. And then they had the officers club. And like the officers club was the high deal, you know, and it kind of went down. So like, when I was 15, you know, I'd have to get somebody to drive me to the enlisted men's club. And those guys were, I guess, right out of boot camp. So I'm 15, but they're only like 18. So there's really not that big a, you know, difference between the people, you know, I was playing for. And so, you know, I was making money at 15, you know, playing in bars, I guess. Nice. You could say, or, you know, these.
So did your parents play music, or like, how did you pick up a guitar?
My parents were divorced real early, like I think I was six, and my dad, I don't ever remember him being really around. He was a DJ, and so he would be in one city and he'd be in another. My mom was, it was getting to the point where my sister was about to start school, you know, kindergarten, and so that's, she's, you know, just kind of had to make the decision that she couldn't be following him around from city to city, that we needed a little more stable. Me and my sister's 2.5 years older than I am. And so that's kind of what happened there. And my dad, he was a mess anyway, you know. So you know, I've got half brothers and sisters here and there. And occasionally, you know, there'll be a phone call and it'll be like, you know, oh, hey. You know, I think your dad and my dad are the same, you know. That's happened a few times.
Oh, that's funny.
But my mom said, I think we were in Memphis. I was 2.5, maybe 3. And the Arsenal was just really getting fired up over there. And they were, you know, offering work. And my mom said, you know, if they would give her anything out of the secretarial field, that she would take it. And they did, and so that's how we got to Huntsville.
Wow.
And, like, music, I guess I was, it's weird, you know, you have it in the church, you know, and so, you know, we were in the church every time the doors were open, and, you know, I would hear all the men singing, real low, and I thought, that's awesome, you know, that's what I want to do. And of course you grow up and you realize you don't want to be a bass singer, you know. You want to be a tenor, you know, not a bass. But and then, so, you know, I heard the music in the church, and my dad had all these records, and we just played with them as kids, like a little turntable, you know, in the 45s, and tons of them were just demos that people. In those days, the DJs had more control over what got played. Like, my dad could probably slip in, you know, like, some songs here and there. And so he would listen to, I don't know, I mean, we had boxes and boxes of 45s where, you know, I guess somebody had been to a studio, recorded a 45, and then took them around all the radio stations hoping, you know, that somebody would hear them. And, so I played with those, and I mainly liked, when I was a kid, the funny ones and the quirky ones, you know. I wasn't really into the romantic songs or anything at that time, you know, just the funny ones and stuff. But I knew that, like, if I ever saw somebody play, like, you know, I would always, when we would go up to Chattanooga to see my aunt, a lot of times on they had these little tourist trap things on the side of the road, like going up to Lookout Mountain and stuff, and sometimes it might be somebody actually playing a guitar out there on, and I'd be like having a fit, like, stop, let's watch, and no, we can't, you know, we got to keep going, you know. But I remember, just anytime I saw live music, you're, even if I didn't get to hear it, I'd get pretty excited. And I walked to school every day, and
where'd you go?
In elementary school, it was East Clinton.
Okay. School. I grew up in Huntsville.
Yeah. So right there in Five Points.
Yeah.
We started off on Wales, but where the cemetery is.
Yep.
And then we went to Ward next, as my mom's job got better. And then we moved to Gladstone. And that's where she bought. We rented, you know, basement apartment there on Wales, and then rented a house on Ward, and then bought a house on Gladstone. So, cool. But I would walk to East Clinton from Ward, and there was a little music store there called Dole's Music. So every day I'd walk by it, and they would have guitars like that, you know, just hanging in the window. And it was just like, oh, you know, why? My dad, as far as I know, I know he didn't play. He had some brothers and sisters, I found out later, that did play. So it's kind of weird, you know, that was just like hollering out to me at like, you know. And I know I begged for a guitar for at least a year before I ever got one. And I think it was $24, and I'd saved up $12, half of it of my allowance, you know, and then my mom put in the other. And I got my first guitar, and I was probably 9 or 10. So.
And you were just self-taught? You just messed around?
Well, I took lessons for, I don't know if it was a year. I know that we had Mel Bay Book 1, and my guitar teacher, you know, I thought he was grown, but looking back on it now, he was probably 18. And he would come in for the first 5 minutes of my lesson and point to something in the book and then disappear and go smoke cigarettes, I think. And then he would come back the last 5 minutes and go, okay, do this next week. And he would point to the next lesson in the book. So I'd go home and try to figure out what that book, you know. And I really wasn't reading. I was memorizing. I could figure out, okay, this is a C note, and it's supposed to go for 2 beats. And then this is a E note, and it's supposed to go for 4 beats. So, I just memorized the stuff. I really quit. I would just go through it like that and listen to it. And so I knew that the Beatles played chords. And there was no chords. They weren't teaching me chords. They were teaching me like Mary Had a Little Lamb type little one note things, you know. And it was like, I peeked at the back of the book and I saw that at the very back they were putting 2 and 3 notes together at the same time. And I thought, oh, if I can make it through this book, I'm going to get to the stuff I want to know, you know. And about the time I was getting to the end of the book, that guy quit teaching, and an older man who was really good, I know now, I didn't then, came in and he caught me. Like, he went back to the middle of the book and he said, play this. I couldn't remember it, you know. I was just memorizing my little weekly thing, you know, and it was like, I got busted, you know. He saw I couldn't read. And he said, okay, we're going to start back over at the beginning of this book. And I said, no, I can't do it. And so I quit taking lessons because I just couldn't bear the thought of going through that book again there. I'd finally gotten to the end of all that crap, you know. But luckily, my sister started dating a guy that could play really well when I was 12 when she started dating him. And how he learned all that stuff he knew, I don't know, because he was only like 15. But man, he knew all the Hendrix stuff. He knew everything, you know. Like, how you know? And they nicknamed me Marvel because I would just come and marvel when he would play. I would just sit there and watch him. Like, that's just incredible. And he taught me a few things, and I tried not to bug him. You know, he would pretty much whatever he wanted to show me, that's what I would learn, and I wouldn't bug him again until I had learned it, and then he would show me something new. And so he passed away, I guess, 2 months ago. Yeah. And then his little brother passed away like a month ago. And, you know, it's like a lot of the people that, you know, were right there in the beginning of my guitar playing time, now guitar players, they're gone.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool, though. And so you just soaked it all up.
Yeah. And then, you know, I guess a good thing for me, too, is like, you know, I was always playing in some kind of band. And I guess I was the best guitar player in the band in 8th grade. But in 9th grade, I met this guy named Kurt Swaggart. And the guy he was like maybe 2 years older. I guess he was a senior in high school when I was going into 10th, so he was a couple years older, but he looked like he was 40 years old when he was, you know, He was already bald and had this big mustache, and you know, and that guy was just, he could listen to Allman Brothers or whatever, and he would tell the bass player what to play. He would give me my part. He would give everybody their parts, and when we played what he told us to play, we sounded great.
Oh, know? My gosh.
And then he was the kind of guy, too, that would just be patting you on the back the whole time, like, I said, you're great, man, you're great. And I'm going, you showed me everything to do here, but I'm trying, you know. But, yeah, I learned a lot from him. And
What did you like stylistically back then? Did you ever circle back around to the Beatles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, probably right about that time, you know, I met started working with a bass player named Jimmy Clay, and he plays with Cosmic Mama and like all this. He was like the biggest Beatle fan on the planet, you know, and he knew every Beatles song the way Kurt knew Allman Brothers and stuff. He knew the bass parts. He knew what the vocalists should sing, what Paul sang, what John sang, what George, when George pipes in, which part he had. He just knew it all. And so he was here at the studio a couple of years ago. We were going up to Casino to play, and I told him he could sleep here, and I slept here too because we had to get up early in the morning. And I started playing like Beatles songs that he had showed me how to play, and he didn't remember. And I said, you don't remember? You showed me this, you know. He didn't remember any of it, you know.
You must have a really good memory.
Yeah, my mom did too, and that's probably, she's got dementia pretty bad now, you know, I may go the same way as she is. I guess I should be reading up on that stuff now, see if there's a way to slow it down.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
So let's get back to your time in the Shoals.
Okay, yeah.
So like... you played with the Iguana Party, right?
Right.
Tell me a little bit about, like, the La Fonda years. Mm-hmm. And, like, kind of, like, what that meant to you and maybe what that meant to other people. I mean, I've heard interviews with Isbell and other people just about how important that was. Like, did y'all feel that at the time? Like, was it important at the time, or were y'all just kind of, like, just playing to play?
Oh, it was important. I'll back up just a little bit to get to La Fonda. When the Shooters, when the record deal was over, and we were going to do a third album, but Walt just decided to pull the plug on it. I maybe first experimented with teaching a little bit. Wayne Counts offered me to teach a little bit. So I got my feet wet just a little bit there. But then an audition came up, and I went back to school, too, for long enough to take a computer class, some stuff. So, but Marie Osmond, like Gary went out with Marie Osmond. So their guitar player was leaving, their acoustic guitar player, and he got me an audition. I got that gig. So then I was out on the road with her for 4 years. When I came back from the Marie gig, got back into teaching, and I was doing like some computer type music, you know, like, and I was getting pretty sick of it. You know, it got my timing really good because I was playing with a computer all the time. You know, everything was perfect. But, you know, and the old La Fonda was across the street from where the famous La Fonda was, I guess you could say, the more famous. Although the old one was famous for, you know, being, I guess, the only Mexican restaurant in the area for a long time. So it had its own thing. But Ronnie Knight and Joey and Danny had a band called Barrel House. And they did mainly blues. And that's what Ronnie, you know, loved. And when Ronnie wouldn't make it, they would got me to fill in a couple times. And that's how, you know, I already kind of knew Danny. He lived next door to my in-laws. And he would come over and talk to me sometimes when I'd be over there. And then Joey would, he owned Pegasus, So it's kind of like everybody knew Joey, you know, through the record store. So Ronnie decided he's going to build guitars. And so he starts doing the Blue South company, where he built the Blue South guitars. And he did the Jimmy Johnson model and quite a few things like that. And so they asked me, you know, to join. And this is probably, I think I did 1 week, maybe 2 weeks in the old building before. And Mary Mason was already coming in and sitting in with Barrel House. And she was a great singer and, you know, pretty charismatic on stage, too. So when they got the new building, you know, we went in there, it was like, I guess I felt, you know, you're asking me if it was important or whatever. I felt like I had this mentality that I had to make it work or I was going to have to find something else to do. So I kind of got this, occasionally in my life I can get this bulldog mentality, which doesn't happen really that often. I'm normally not that driven. But I had my kids, I had two small kids, and, you know, it was kind of like, I need to make this work. Or I'm going to have to find something to make it, you know, to make ends meet. And so I was, you know, I wanted to keep a lot of the blues element that Ronnie had started. So we were always known for playing the rock and the bluesy stuff, but then we did Danny liked the dance music and the entertainment stuff more, so he kind of brought that into it, and Joey liked a lot of stuff, so we just kind of learned whatever, and then Mary did, you know, the R&B stuff, and that was great, and, you know, things were, I guess that back room, you know, you might get 75 to 100 people back there. But the cool thing, you know, about it, it's that room sounded awesome to me. It was like the low ceilings, kind of acoustic tile in this crappy indoor-outdoor carpet, you know. But you could play pretty loud in there, and it didn't seem like you were very loud. So something was sucking up the sound. Like I played a Marshall in there and was pretty much letting it go pretty good, you know. And they can hurt you, you know, if you're, you know, but that room for some reason it seemed to allow it, and so it seemed like, you know, we were just packing it out every Saturday night. Of course, there were only, if you wanted live music, you either went to the bowling alley, and they played country music, or you came over and listened to us, and we played the rock and the blues and the soul, and we. You know, we had a little dance floor, and I guess they had a little dance floor over at the bowling alley. So that was it. That was your choices, you know, probably on a Saturday night in Florence, Alabama.
You know, and what year would this have been?
I'm thinking it's like 95 or 6 would be my guess. And because I came off the road of Marie, I think, in 94. Spent about a year in Huntsville playing, and so I'm thinking it was about that would put it around 96, 90, and it wasn't long before, you know, first of all, Chris Tompkins came in. We were just a three-piece band, so we had room to expand, you know what I mean, and so it, and Chris came in one night, and I think asking if he could sit in or something, and I said, well, sing a little bit for me, you know, and on break or something, and he had a good voice, you know, and he sang real high, and so I said, yeah, last set, you know, we'll get you up, so we got him up, and he sang, and he came up to me after, he said, man, I got a friend that plays guitar, he said, if I get him down here next week, would you let him play? He said, he's good. I said, I let him play. You know, I took Chris's word for it. And that next week in walks Jason Isbell. You know, he's 15. I guess his mama drops him off, you know. And man, he was just like, he had his game face on, man. He was not there to kid around. You know, at 15, he had drawn a bead on what he was going to do with his life, man. And, you know, and I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, that this kid walks in, this, you know, and he would just solo all night. He'd solo over the vocals. He'd solo over everything. And I hated to do it, but, you know, I'd like, I'd say, Jason, stop. Hold on, man. Don't play what she's singing. You know, wait a minute. Okay, go. You know, he'd just go to you. He was kind of like, you know, teetotaler. Okay, stop. Okay, go. Stop. You know, but he was a quick study, man. He started figuring all that out pretty quick, like how to play in a band and how to play, you know. And we'd play songs that featured guitar, you know, and me and him would go at it like for long, sometimes, you know, extended solos and stuff where it, you know, and it was kind of tough on me, you know. I'm grown and everything. I'm around 40, late 30s, 40. Here's this kid just smoking, you know. It's like, so I'd go home after La Fonda and practice, because it's like, I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to, you know, get ate up by a 15-year-old, you know, because, I mean, his hands are just incredibly fast, you know, and his brain was fast, and everything about him was quick, you know, and I'm more methodical and slow, and so, but yeah, so he was great for me. He was as good for me as I was for him, because I was also a little bit bored with music in general. Like, turn on the radio, felt like I'd heard everything before, and I was kind of in a stale place a little bit, and so he kind of pulled me out of that. And him and Chris knew great songs better than I knew great songs. And some of the great songs that I showed them, I mean, they picked up on immediately. Like, you know, we'd do a Steely Dan song, and it'd be like, "Who is that?" I'm going, "That's Steely Dan," you know, and they're going like, "That's good." And I'm going, "Yeah," you know. But then they're teaching me, you know, like, John Prine and you know, Poncho and Lefty, and, like, you know, Townes Van Zandt stuff, you know, they were already kind of hip to that. It's like, how at 15, you know? But I think it was they grew up in more musical families where they were listening to more music and different kinds of music like that, where I was always doing the top 40 thing, you know, or, and then some Allman Brothers and Beatles and, you know, stuff like that.
What did Chris and Jason play that first night when they came in?
The first thing Chris played the first night was he did an Eagles song. He did "Take It Easy," and he sang it higher than they did. I had to put a capo on and raise it up. That's how high his voice was, like raised up like a whole step. I said, "Are you sure?" "Yeah," you know. And man, sure enough, he's singing up there. And Isbell, Mike, didn't really like to sing, but you could get him to pipe in on some harmony. Sometimes I could tell, like, man, he can sing, you know. He's but didn't really care. He just wanted to burn guitar all night long. That was his passion, you know. And
you don't remember what they played?
They played everything we played.
Yeah,
like, just whatever our playlist was. Yeah. And then Chris started bringing his keyboard out and playing with us on keys. And
that's cool. So that kind of was like a renaissance for you, just like being reinvigorated or whatever.
Yeah, and you know, youth, you know, when it's just a wonderful invigorator, you know, it's like being around. So as soon as their friends heard that we were letting young people play, you know, and it was a restaurant, so you didn't have to show an ID or anything to get in. And another cool thing, as I look back on La Fonda, besides it being a great sounding room, there were no TVs on back there. People that came there, they came to hear music, and it was 100% of why they were there. They, you know, and, or, you know, they might have been wanting to meet a girl there or something like that, but, you know, once you got back there in the room, there was no TV to pull your attention away from the music. And so everybody got to play there. They really got the experience of having people just, like, really sitting there watching every move they made. And so, like I said, once Jason's and Chris's high school friends learned that, we were let, all of a sudden there was, like, this whole influx of people, you know, their age coming in. And, Shauna Tucker, you know, was coming in, and we would let her get up and play. And then Matt, what's Matt's last name? it'll come to me in a little bit. But
so what did y'all think about that? What did y'all think about all these young kids wanting to get up?
I loved it, you know, and they were so cool, you know, and so LaFonda, you know, they were probably losing money on the kids, so they kind of did like maybe a $5 minimum, like they needed to buy some cheese dip and get a Coke or something if they were going to sit there all night long. But, you know, they were really, I know that, you know, they would probably like to have a little older clientele, but probably in retrospect now they're probably really glad they did it the way they did it and let the young people come in there and have a place to, you know, to kind of hang out. That was it. They felt like adults, you know, like they'd be in there with the adults and they would be, you know, everybody just kind of was there for music. The kids were there for the music, and because it was cool, it was live, you know, and the adults were there for the music, and it was high level music, I would say. It was, you know, everybody could play, and if there were a few people that, you know, caught on and that maybe weren't going to be career musicians, but I mean, so many of them did become career musicians, you know, that were in there at that time. That does seem to be a way that seems like good musicians kind of come in waves, you know, like that. Like, all of a sudden there's a class of a year or two within, and there'll be a whole bunch of them. And then you might be kind of a 5 to 7, 10 year drought of, you know, there's one or two in that time period, but. But just sometimes it just seems like there's this little renaissance of really good people. And that's, you know, all those young kids from up around Green Hill and all, man, they were musical people.
So do you think, like, how important was LaFonda to them? Like, do you think that would have happened if they hadn't had that opportunity to really just, like, do it in that, like, in that setting, you know?
I don't know. That's almost impossible to answer, isn't it? Like, yeah. I thought about that kind of thing, and it's just, I do know it's kind of a magical time.
Opportunity is important.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. You can be really talented, but if you don't have the opportunity, I mean, yeah. You know, and that's what it seemed like. I mean, I kind of came in on the tail end of that. I remember going to LaFonda a couple times before, I guess, they closed or whatever, but, like,
yeah, the last year or so was not the heyday.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It was, it had seen, it was changing. And
but it feels like we're missing that, you know, like Pegasus is gone. Yeah. And like, where's somebody going to go to like learn or to really soak it in, you know? Yeah. And it's like, I don't know. Where are people going to go, you know? And like, it just feels like a void right now, like, for like, that situation of, like, having, like, a mentor or someone to just, like, look at and try to, like, replicate or whatever it is, you know, or just an opportunity to, like, show your chops, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Oh, no. I wish there was more of that.
I do, too. You know, another great person that came through, John Davis, you know? And when we did Zeppelin, you know, John is like, he can just kill on some John Bonham stuff. And it was like, you know, he'd get up and we'd do Zeppelin stuff, you know, and it was just like he'd be doing that quick kick drum stuff. He was awesome, man. And
that's cool.
And I'm missing, like, Bo Bias when he was here. He came through LaFonda. Marie Osmond one night when she was in town, she came into LaFonda and sat in with us. And yeah, it's just nuts. You never knew. And I'm leaving out just probably tons of people that came through there and played, you know, Pete Carr. You know, Walt and Gary came in a couple times.
So what'd you do after that? Like, what's kept you busy? Like in the last 20 years or whatever it's been.
Since LaFonda?
I mean, yeah, just since that time period, you know?
I'm not sure. I would guess LaFonda went down 07. I just picked that number and it's...
Yeah, maybe, that sounds about right.
Yeah. And so at first it was kind of a relief, because it had gotten to the point to try to get a drummer in there every Friday night, like Chad and Jimbo too. So Chad, I would, when they weren't on the road, I just told Chad, this is your gig until you don't want it anymore or can't, you know. So Chad and Jimbo both playing in there a lot. And so let's see. But then I was, seemed like I was always trying to get a good bass player in there on Friday night and a good drummer. And then, you know, Joey would be there and on Saturday nights. And Danny came and went. And so I was having to try to find a drummer. Trent Owen is a very fine drummer that came through there. And I think he lives in Nashville now. So he's another career. There was just, that place was just ate up with people that wound up, you know, or they were, you know, they had that mentality that they were going to be career players. And so, you know, that was a relief, not every Friday and Saturday night, like having to, you know, like try to be the manager of this thing. And so it wasn't very long after that that James asked me to join the Midnighters. And so, you know, that kind of took the place of the LaFonda thing, you know, getting to play it out. But it was, it's way different because, you know, pretty much Midnighters, you know, I might do a couple songs a night, where LaFonda I was doing, you know, 90%, you know, or 80, or, you know, Danny and Joey, they did some, but I
you mean just like singing?
Yeah, I did the lion's share of, you know, when I was the front guy, you know.
Yeah,
pretty much. So and then, you know, my, I always had the teaching, so that was always good. I did done a lot of church service. You know, I did a church in Huntsville for probably 12 years or more, and it was kind of going at the same time as LaFonda. So when I'd leave LaFonda on a Saturday night, sometimes at 2 and 3 in the morning, I'd get to Huntsville at 4, you know, 5 in the morning, and get up at 8 and go do a church service in the morning. And I did that for years and years. You know, Jason and Chris asked me one time, you know, why do you do that? How can you do that? I said, well, you know, it's important to me. I said, you know, so if something's important to you, you find a way to do it. And I said, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So, that's good. I just recently got rehired at that church during this Corona thing. And it seemed like, you know, God is taking care of me. The money I lost from not being able to do Midnighters and all that stuff is being made up for, you know.
Yeah, I think, I remember, I don't know if it's the same church, but, like, I showed up, I live in Huntsville, and my mom's always just like, come to church with me, you know, mm-hmm. like. So I was in town, I was like, yeah, I'll go to church, and then I show up, and you're up there singing, I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
And he's everywhere.
Yeah. Now, that was the church that I wound up joining after the sure. one that I did for years.
Sure, yeah.
And
I just thought it was funny. I was listening, yeah. man.
Yeah.
These Shoals guys, man. It's
man,
everywhere.
I don't know if you went many times before that, but the preacher's wife and all, Heather, that was there before, I don't know if she was already gone the day that you came there or not.
Yeah, I don't remember. I go about once a year to that church.
Yeah. She was great, and both of her sons were great. Like, and then there was two other, like, that's one thing that drew me to that church. It was youth again. It was like, man, I looked up there on that stage, and it was like, oh, that was like four guys that were probably in high school that could all play, you know.
Wow.
And I was like, I like this place. And she could sing, and she was real well organized, and she really made it nice. And then about the time I joined the band, they start graduating from high school and moving off to college. And all of a sudden, there's just me up there. And I'm like, dang it. And then the preacher leaves, and she leaves. And then I become kind of the guy there for a year or so, maybe a little over a year. But I was kind of glad to get out of there. So that was tough.
Yeah, that's tough.
When you got I wasn't used to my – having to do hymns and stuff, I'd gotten kind of used to this more modern, you know, because that's, I would do a few hymns, but, you know, now they were really wanting to lean a whole lot more on the old, really old stuff, and because of the age of the congregation. You know, I understand why they were doing it, but I really didn't want to go back to that material. So
tell me a little bit about, like, teaching and what that's like for you, and maybe a little bit of your, like, original music. You told me earlier you're, mm-hmm. like, working on cutting some of your own stuff.
Yeah. Well, I've had a couple cuts on the Steel Drivers. I had a song on the album that won a Grammy, a song called Brother John is on the album that won the Grammy, and I had one on the one before that, the Hammer Down CD, that was called Shallow Grave, and about had one on this new one that just came out, but that I wrote, the two that I did, I wrote with Gary Nichols, and so, you know, I've got like a Grammy participation certificate, you know, so. That you have to pay for those things, you know, like $50 a piece. And I still haven't put them up anywhere. They're just in some envelope somewhere. I think that was, song was probably 2016, maybe, something like that. Isbell has been great. Like, I've gotten to do some really cool gigs with him. Like, occasionally he'll just call me up and it'll be like, hey, you know, you want to come, you know, do this? And yeah, you know, and it'll always be like something just killer, you know, like getting to play the Ryman. I got to play the Ryman.
So he'll just have you come up and sit in with the band?
No, I played with his wife, Amanda.
Oh, yeah.
I played with her for a while.
That's awesome.
One time it was, this is probably in 13, said, you want to come down and play in Birmingham? And I said, sure. And he said, there'll be some special guests there and stuff. And he wouldn't tell me, you know, or didn't tell me who they were. And it didn't matter to me. I said, yeah, I'd be glad to. And they had just had their trailer and stuff broken into. So he didn't have an amp. So I brought him an extra amp to play and some different stuff. I had let him use my Marshall, and I used my little Deluxe. And turned out the special guests were like Paul Schaefer you know, and David Letterman then was, I didn't know it, but he came in and we took a break, and I was back in the break room, and all of a sudden, like, here comes David Letterman walking up to me. I was by myself back there, and he's like, I just want to tell you thank you, you know, and what a great job you're doing, all this stuff, and hung out with Paul Schaefer like all day. You know, we were rehearsing and then we were just talking, and he was just really cool. And that was for Habitat for Humanity. I think Letterman doesn't, you know, announce it that much, but I think that's one of his big charities that he likes to contribute to, so that's what that show was all about. And then when Southeastern came out before Sadler, Sadler had quit Driving and Crying, I think, to join Jason's group, but he had to fulfill maybe a couple weeks there before he could do it, so I went out with Jason for like 2 weeks at that time, and that was right at when Southeastern had come out. And it was funny because that was the time when he was starting to blow up in his own way. And it was like, because we'd be going to a venue that they had played maybe the year before, you know, and Chad and Jim would go, God, I hope we do good tonight, you know, hope we sell some tickets, you know, because maybe like it was only half full or something. And like, you know, they'd come back going, sold out. You know, and then the next venue, I hope we, you know, get some people at this one, and be like, come back, sold out. You know, it was like the venues were all selling out, and they were kind of, you could see that they were pleasantly surprised that these venues were selling out. And, you know, the truckers were more of they had a lot more male following than they did female. You know, you go to a trucker show, it was a bunch of dudes, you know, most of the time.
Yeah.
And there were more girls coming to these shows. And they, you know how people, this didn't used to be the way, but they know the words to every song. It's like, you know, you walk out there, you know, and like everybody in the crowd is singing along and they know all the words to all Jason's songs. And it's like, well, that's really cool, you know, it's catching on. And it's the new album and it hadn't been out. I'm trying to think. This was probably, it was right around the 4th of July when we were out, because I remember flying home to do a 4th of July gig I'd promised somebody, and then flying back out to some other city. And So I think it was probably released in February or something. So it had been out like March, April, May, June, July, maybe 5 months. And the last place we played was track 13 in Chattanooga. And it was like a sort of like an air hangar or something, and it would hold. That's the only place that didn't sell out. And it was like, there were people like, you know, I think it would hold, they sold 900, and it might would have held not many more than that. They almost sold out that place.
Wow.
Because they had a way they could cut it in half, you know, where they could keep it, and, you know, they had the whole thing open.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So when Jason calls you to, like, go out on the road, are you, like, queuing up all the CDs and listening to him and practicing, or do you just kind of, like, can you wing it?
Well,
I know you can kind of play anything, right?
Yeah, but, you know, like, I guess he did me kind of like I did him at La Fonda. Like, he didn't know I was going to play and just play, you know? So when he just says, you know, do you want to come? And then, when I went out for those 2 weeks, I found their online, you know, they have their set list and stuff. So I found out what songs they had been playing and went to Joey's and got it on an MP3 player. And I charted everything one night, and then like on the airplane and stuff, flying out, like I was listening to it in headphones and maybe kind of looking over my charts and maybe what I thought I would probably be playing as opposed to what Jason might be playing. And
so you studied a little?
Yeah, I did. And that, I got kind of, the first gig was kind of a more of a college thing and a lot of beer drinking and sloshing going on out there. So that was really easy. Like, people weren't just like zeroing in on what I was doing, you know. And so I thought, oh, this is going to be easy, you know. And then I think the very next gig was like a dinner theater thing where people sitting right where you are, like checking out every note I'm playing. It was like, oh, this is hard. And the best night I played was at the Birchmere in Virginia, Alexandria, Virginia, maybe. Real cool venue. And I had been up for 24 hours, I think. I'd flown home to do that 4th of July. It was probably July 5th. I'd done that and turned right around, got back on an airplane, flew back up there, and we didn't have a hotel room yet. So, like, I got to the gig, and when we sound checked, we just kind of hung out in the dressing room. And I was like, I'd been up like over 24 hours. I was drinking Red Bulls and doing the 5-hour energy drinks, and I was just trying not to fall asleep, like, on stage, you know. And I played the best that night. I guess I wasn't worried, you know. I was past the point of where I could worry. And there's still some of that footage on YouTube. And I felt like I played good that night. Then I got overconfident, and the next night I didn't play as well. You know, I thought, I got this now. And it was like, nah, you ain't got it. Yeah. I played okay, but, you know, it wasn't as good. I was hoping I'd hit another level at it, but it was going to take a little longer to do that.
That's wild. So do you enjoy writing and doing that?
Yeah, a lot. I've written, you know. I don't write enough. Like, if I'm just left to wait for inspiration, I probably won't write 3 songs a year. But if I make my, you know, if I either, that's one good thing for me about co-writing, you know, if I can tell somebody, okay, I'll meet you here at this time and we'll sit down and, you know, we'll, that really, you know, I'm always going to be there and I'm always going to be trying to, you know, come up with something. And the Steel Drive was really cool because when Gary called me for that, you know, it was a specific thing in mind. It was like, I hadn't really listened to the Steel Drivers on that first time, you know, and it was like, so I, he said, you know, you want to write for the Steel Drivers project? I said, yeah, of course, you know. And then I went and started listening to some of their stuff, and it didn't sink in how good some of that Chris Stapleton writing really was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was listening to their older stuff, you know, and it was like, now it like hits me on a whole other level, like how really good a lot of that early Steel Drivers music is. And but I feel like we can't, you know, got it up, you know, a pretty good quality, you know. I think Brother John's a good song. Jason, as a matter of fact, Jason probably helped me get that cut. He acted like he didn't, but you know, I think they were looking for another song to cut. And I got, you know, this one song I wrote with Barry Billings. He said, let's hear that Barry Billings song. You know, Gary told me. So he heard it. Said, yeah, let's cut that one. You know, and it was a slower song, and Steel Drivers don't like to cut slow stuff because they're kind of a bluegrass thing. So that's probably why it didn't. It was actually the first song we wrote. And they had tried to cut it, I think.
You wrote that with Gary?
Uh-huh, Gary Nichols, yeah. And Brother John, too. Brother John, say, that was the first one, and it went so well, and we got it done so quickly that I had another title called, normally if I'm going to something like that, I can show you my phone, I've got used scrolling of possible titles, anything I think might sounds good to me, I'll put in my phone. And so and there's some I have much stronger feelings about than others. Like I'd had that Shallow Grave and I just felt like I had something to say about that. I didn't know what, you know, it was going to be. But and that one, I actually talked Gary into writing on it maybe 3 times. Like, he was fine with it after the first write. And I'm going like, well, let me, you know, I can't much do that. It's like, let me go home and think about this and revisit it. And so then I came back and got it a lot closer. I said, because really I was still trying to figure out what the song was about, you know. And then I talked him into writing one more time on it, you know, one more rewrite. And I said, when third time, I said, I know what the song is about now. You know, it's about addictions, you know. And then, you know, like you try to put your addictions away, you try to bury them in a shallow grave, but they come back on you, you know. So once I had the concept, then I was happy, you know. Like, and I've heard other writers say that sometimes they'll write a song and they won't know what it's about for 5 years. And so sometimes it just, over the period of time of doing a song, you figure out why you wrote the line you wrote. Sometimes, like, my brain will do that. Sometimes it's like, I know this line's right. I can't tell you why it's right, but this is what needs to be right here, right now. Then later on, you'll be like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Now I see why it had to be that. So I think it's cool when I read that other people do this, you know, have the same, that's almost like a phenomenon, you know, happen. You know, yeah. Like,
do you think having to be intentional about writing music and lyrics is like, I don't want to say like helps you become a better person, but like changes the way you see the world or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, does it inform like how your life, you know, does that process like forge something inside of you, or is it just something that you do, you know what I mean?
I guess they're different, you know, according to how the inspiration hits you. You know, like when you're writing, like sometimes I try to write these songs where I tell a story that makes sense, but that's not what I'm saying at all. You know, you could read it that way, but really everything's a metaphor, you know, for something else, you know, I mentioned that to Isabel one time, and he said, man, that's hard to do. You know, like, that's really hard to do. I'm going, okay, maybe that's why I struggle so much with certain songs. And I guess the more you listen to great writers, like, you know, you start picking up on, I've learned so much more about lyric writing in the last, I feel like I just keep getting better, because, you know, when you start getting, like, I didn't listen to Bruce Springsteen, you know, and it was like, you know, I knew his hits from the 80s and stuff, and Jordan Denton would be playing Atlantic City, you know, and I didn't know what it was really, and I'd be like, man, do that Chicken Man song again. Yeah, and I kept getting more into the story. Like, I'd get like, okay, I think I see what's going on. And then, like, bing, the whole thing opens up, you know, and you realize that he's doing a hit on a guy. You know, he's getting ready to kill somebody. And it's like, it's just so cool, you know, that, you know, when, and I would like to write. It raises the bar, like in your own lyric writing. You start looking like, I ain't got nothing. That, you know, the great writers, like if they're going to kill somebody, they find the coolest ways to say it. Like in Pancho and Lefty, the dust that Pancho bit down south ended up in Lefty's mouth. Mm. You know, he could have said he shot him, you know. And now he's feeling the taste of that, of murdering somebody or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, there's a lot more common way to say that than that. And Bruce Springsteen saw in the way that he lets you know that he's going to do a hit. He says, and I met a man last night, and I'm going to do a little favor for him. Yes, I am. That's how he said it, you know. Nice. You know, and you got to kind of put it together. You know, that's so cool.
That's awesome. So I'll ask you one more thing, and then we probably better wrap it up because I could probably sit here and talk all night, but my wife probably wouldn't like that as much as I would. So the Shoals as like a music, I don't know, it has a history of music, a legacy in the recording industry, I guess you should say.
Yes.
Like, where do you think, like, I don't see a lot of the, like, huge hits that were, like it was back in the 60s and 70s, you know? I don't know if it'll ever really be like that again. I mean, I know there's, like, a lot of great studios doing a lot of great things, but, like, where do you see the music going or the town going in relation to music, like, into the future? You know what I mean? Like, is there going to be a legacy that keeps evolving, like, after maybe some of the, like, shine wears off of, the, like, the recording? You know, they had that resurgence after the movie and all the documentary and all that stuff. Yeah. You know, like, maybe in 10 or 15 years, like, what's going to be left? Like, do you think things will still, like, keep propelling this area forward as, like, a music town, you know?
I think so, you know, because it's just the talent that's here. You know, it, how could it not succeed? You know, there's just, as long as the talent keeps coming, you know.
Do you see that with, like, the younger kids?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's going to be another crop. I mean, you know, John Paul, you know, and, you know, what they're doing over there. You know, there's some talented people over there. And, you know, Isbell doing well from here. And, you know, Bay Simpson's group, you know, the Outlaw Apostles, they're hacking away at it, trying to write some good stuff, you know, and they sound good. So I think as long as there's talent, you know, lots of talent, and I don't know, I had one little theory, like maybe why Shoals, like, it seems like great music seems like is always pretty close to water for whatever reason. You know, there's probably maybe a few places, you know, where there's some real high level known music that wasn't around water, but most of the time it's like, you know, it's going to be close to water. I don't know if Macon, Georgia, if there's any water over there.
I would guess so.
Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah, I think there's something to that too, for sure.
I know when I moved over here, it felt like home immediately. It was like, oh, I wish I'd moved away from Huntsville like 20 years sooner, you know, and just came over here because, I don't know, I guess just the community of songwriters and musicians, it was, it just felt good, you know. People weren't just all about the top 40, it seemed like in Huntsville, you know, it was such a cover town, and still is for the most part. They've gotten a little bit better, but, you know, of course we're a cover town too, I guess every town is, but it seemed like they're a little more accepted, and there's still some industry over here, and it doesn't take a lot to get someone excited, you know, about being able to make a living playing music. Seemed like it'd be a good time to be alive if you were young, you know, just get you a U-Haul and a van and some talented friends and go do a CD and just hit all the colleges and try to convince the people at the colleges that, you know, that they needed to buy your CD, you know, and then come back in a year and do it again with this new CD. And seemed like it, you know, you could, if you got your own get up and go to do that, it's a good time, because you used to be, you just had to seem like deal with big labels and stuff. So
that's awesome. Yeah, it sounds like a fun life.
It's tough, you know. I know Jason, man, when he left the Truckers, you know, he was doing that. And, you know, they were sleeping on those bench seats in that van, and they had it rough, you know. And Jason would be driving the van after the gigs, and they'd be traveling long miles, you know. So he did it. You know, he paid his dues for sure.
You paid your dues.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've really kind of had it easy, I think, compared to, like, my days on the road, the hardest ones were probably Cornelius Brothers, because we were in a van pulling a U-Haul. But once we'd get, like, in the summer, we'd just play Myrtle Beach, and we'd be in, we didn't have to go anywhere. We'd just be, like, playing the Admiral Showroom in Myrtle Beach.
Oh, my gosh. You know,
two shows a day, and we had the rest of the day off, and we were getting paid good. And so that was a pretty cush thing. In the winter, it got a little, we did more one-nighters and moving around. That was a little bit harder. But, like, Marie Osmond was so easy. It was like we had two buses. All the gigs make sense. You know, you'd leave at, like, 12 o'clock at night, sleep on the bus. You'd wake up in the morning, you'd be at your hotel, and you'd get up and go in. If you wanted to lay back down, you could. And we'd have a sound check and then a gig and then do it all again. Like, and we were only out, like, 3 or 4 days a week. So I'd be home 3 or 4 days a week. You know, Isbell would go out and not see, you know, home for long periods of time. And they were all, the whole band was doing that. And a lot of people just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to.
Well, cool.
I'm the type of person, I could have done that, you know, because I like it. Like
I that. Believe that.
But, yeah. Yeah, I have that kind of thing. I miss it. I'd like to be on the road, I think, now, but I think it's probably better that I'm around where I kind of keep an eye on my wife and not, you know, she can be kind of accident prone. And, you know, she fell down some steps at our house one time. I had to have brain, like, they had to go in and,
oh my God,
and do the open her up to let the pressure out and all
that.
Gosh. But she recovered from that good. I came in one night from here, and it's on Valentine's Day, I guess 2 years ago, and it's cold, like it's cold outside. And I pull in, and I thought, what is that in the carport? It's her laid out there. She's broken her ankle.
Oh my God.
And she can't get in the house. And she's more worried about the kitty cat, like, T got out, you know, like, okay, T. And I got him back in the house, you know, and take her, and it's like, that was a big mess, you know.
Gosh.
Breaking your ankle is bad, so I don't
know. That does sound horrible.
Yeah.
Is there a restroom here? Okay, cool. Well, man, I'm probably going to think of a bunch of other stuff I want to ask you about,